Today, a look at life in a town when its steel plant closes. And the latest twist in a murder case that's gripped Ireland.
The pride that people in Redcar have really derives from the steel industry. And you don't have to be there for very long before somebody will tell you their favourite fact, which is that the Sydney Harbour Bridge, the steel for that bridge was forged on Teesside.
In 2015, the steel plant and blast furnace in Redcar, a North Yorkshire town, closed for good, ending 170 years of steelmaking in the area.
At the bottom end, where the families are on the working, it's them who pay the price every time.
At least 3,000 workers at the plant and in the supply chain lost their jobs.
Mr. Grable is sat there in his nice office somewhere, and does he really care what happens to the people on Teesside in Scunthorpe?
And now, the town of Scunthorpe in the Midlands has received the news that British Steel, the town's biggest employer, has gone into liquidation, instantly putting 5,000 jobs at risk.
British Steel, which employs thousands of people in Scunthorpe, is due to hear whether it will receive an emergency government bailout.
This is the news that everyone in Scunthorpe hoped never to hear. They have survived decades of difficulties in this industry, and now the company is being liquidated.
So as Scunthorpe waits to see if British Steel will be saved, The Guardian's North of England editor, Helen Pidd, has been back to Redcar to see how the closing of a steelworks can change a community.
You've got to see it to believe it. Everywhere you are in Redcar, it's there. It kind of haunts the skyline. The town's identity is very much kind of forged in the steelworks. There's a really profound sense of loss.
From The Guardian, I'm India Raxon. Today in Focus, what happens to a town when a steelworks closes?
With Scunthorpe then really desperately searching for a buyer at the moment, what does this really mean for steel in the UK?
Well, it might not be the final chapter of steel, but it's certainly got the potential to be one of the closing chapters. You know, in its heyday, the steel industry was employing tens of thousands of people all across the UK. And now we're in a situation where there's really only a small handful of steel plants left. The biggest one is in Port Talbot in South Wales, and there's also some steelmaking that goes on in Scotland. But in England, there's very little left. I've been to Redcar enough over the past couple of years to know just how devastating it can be when steel leaves a town.
And I think we've absolutely gone full circle now, because there's been no lessons learned from what happened then to where we are now. Somebody needs to hold them to task. Where's the government's watchdogs? Where's the teeth?
So Brian Dennis is a 53-year-old former steelworker from Redcar.
I started as a junior operator in 1989, so I was there for just over 26 years. And I finished up a supervisor, a deputy shift manager.
He's quite a big guy. He's got a shiny bald head. He's very friendly, kind of guy that's give you a big firm handshake. So really, all of his working life, 26 years, was spent among the kind of heat and the noise of Redcar steel plants and the blast furnace and the coke ovens. So his whole adult life has been shaped by that experience.
And what happened to Brian and his colleagues in 2015?
So in September 2015, Brian had actually taken the day off work to attend the Labour Party conference. He'd not long been elected, actually, as a Labour councillor in Redcar. And he was sitting in the conference hall when his phone buzzed.
Well, the phones started going off around me. And then the General Secretary took me to one side and sort of said, we're going to shut the works.
And it was the news that he'd been dreading, which was that SSI, the Thai owners of the Redcar steel plant, was going into administration, and his job and the jobs of 2,200 other workers at the Redcar plant were on the line.
Brian Dennis, Community Union, speaking in support of the motion. Conference, I am a proud Teesider.
And he decided that it was worth a last-ditch attempt, a plea to David Cameron, the then Prime Minister, to ask him to save the steel industry.
This morning, I was told I'm losing my job. 6 months ago, my wife was told she was going to be made redundant. We are now a household facing life with no work.
And he really emphasised that it wasn't just about steel, it was about a whole community, it was about families, and it was about a place. And it was a very emotional speech, which really kind of punched you in the guts when you heard it at the time.
I'm asking everyone in this hall, everyone across the UK, stand up for this industry, stand up for our families to save our steel. Thank you.
He got a standing ovation in the conference hall, but it fell on deaf ears in the government, and the government said that it was unable to bail out SSI. At the time, it kind of blamed European Union rules on state aid. For many people, the fact that Redcar and Cleveland, as a local authority, voted 66% leave, many people saw the steelworks closure in the previous year as very much feeding into that decision.
And last week, you went back to Redcar to meet Brian. 4 years on, how are things for him now?
Well, he's a kind of chipper sort of guy. So we met on the beach in Redcar. He'd brought his dog, Darcy. So he got a job at the Calla Glass plant and he does night shifts there. And he didn't seem unhappy, but he was very open about how different his life is now.
If it was still open, I would still be there and I'd have finished my working career there.
And were you proud to work in the steel industry?
I was, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's been lots of anecdotes, the beating out of Teesside and this, that and the other, but it's been there since I was a child growing up in Grangetown. My dad's worked there, my brother worked there, my friends worked there.
So, you know, they're not at risk of having their house repossessed, unlike quite a few of his former colleagues. But life has kind of lost its sparkle, I would say, for Brian and his wife. And he's understandably still quite angry about it.
And when you spend 26 years with a group of guys, and that group didn't change very much, and that's a long time, we were like a family.
And he said, well, you know, there's still quite a lot of bravado and we have a laugh. And the main thing that we do is try to look out for one another. So if somebody's got a new decent job, you know, maybe that's working away. It might be on the oil rigs or some people went to work on Crossrail, the new underground line in London. Then they were always looking out for their mates and saying, oh, you know, you might be able to get a bit of work here. So a lot of them are able to get contracts, but they're short term, which means they've lost their stability and they are quite paranoid about what they will do when that contract finishes.
And it wasn't just the town of Redcar that was hit when the steelworks closed, was it? You also visited a small village just down the road called Carlin Howe, which is built around the Skinning Grove steelworks.
There's still 300 or 400 people who work at the Skinning Grove plant. And what they do there, they make components for earth-moving equipment, diggers and things like that.
And when you were there, you were directed by one of the workers to go and meet a woman called Linda, who was organising a Save Our Steel meeting. Tell me about her.
So I sort of walked up the hill and knocked on her door, and her husband let me straight in, to her slight surprise. She was really lovely and very open.
Our works, as you can see, it's right in the centre of the village. You know, I've grown up listening to the steel clattering and banging, and we don't hear it. People who visit say, oh my goodness, how do you put it? We don't hear it because to us it's really good, a really good positive noise because it means that the works are vibrant.
And what she said was that when she heard the news about British Steel in Scunthorpe, she just felt this kind of this gut punch, really, saying, oh, goodness, those poor families.
Really, because my husband lost his job at the Redcar Steelworks. He was a fitter and he'd worked there for about 36 years when he lost his job. And that uncertainty in a family life is terrible. So when I woke up yesterday morning, I felt, gosh, it was like just an awful feeling. you know, we live in an area of deprivation. We live in an area where we've suffered so much from the austerity measures.
And she wasn't going to just stand by and let it happen.
As I was driving to work this morning, I have a long commute to work. I was driving along and was thinking about how it isn't just about Steel. This is not about just about Steel. It is about a community. It is about the health inequalities, etc., that are caused by what has happened over the last 20 years.
And she talked in quite a beautiful and kind of poetic way, I thought, about the importance of Steel to this village. And you know, Colin Hout is pretty isolated. It's only 10 miles from Redcar, but there's no trains. So the prospects of employment for people, and particularly young people, are very limited. And she was very fearful for what it would mean if British Steel does go under, and with it the Skinning Grove plant. And you've got to remember that there's people working at the Skinning Grove Steelworks in Carlin Howe who thought they were one of the lucky ones because they were the ones who kind of got transferred when SSI closed in Redcar. Some of them from SSI also went to work in Scunthorpe. And yet they're facing the same situation nearly 4 years down the line, the same uncertainty and the same anguish of what's going to happen. The reason I went back to Redcar was to kind of take the temperature of the place nearly 4 years after Steel left the town. And walking around, I really did think, goodness, what's in store for Scunthorpe if that steel plant goes? You know, there's twice as many direct jobs at the Scunthorpe plant as there was in Redcar. And yet the kind of hole that it's left metaphorically in the community in Redcar is enormous.
The recent news of British Steel in Scunthorpe going into liquidation and what this would mean for the town and the industry is at the forefront of many people's minds. Business Secretary Greg Clark has implied that all is not lost. So what happened to British Steel and can it be saved? Nils Prattley is the financial editor at The Guardian and has been following the story.
Britain was a huge steel producer, one of the biggest in the world. Around about 1970, there was 300,000 people working in the steel industry. We're now down to about 30,000, and obviously 5,000 of those are at the rebadged British Steel, centred on the Scunthorpe Steelworks. They produce good quality, excellent quality product. It's just a very, very tough industry to be in.
What's been happening then with British Steel?
The last crisis was 2016. The deal that was done then was for the Scunthorpe plant and a few other assets were sold to a company, Grable Capital, private equity firm. That deal was transacted at a token £1.
Because it was just going downhill.
China is expanding its steel production, opening blast furnaces and producing a lot of steel. So the excess tends to end up on the open market. It drives down prices everywhere. And it's very volatile. You know, the two big ingredients are iron ore and coal. They are both commodities that rise and fall, often sharply, and producers can be caught out.
So British Steel, owned by Grable, the private equity company, that has gone into insolvency. What happened? How did it reach that point?
Well, the factors behind it were not just the poor backdrop in the market. The company itself, Grable, blames Brexit. If the UK were to leave the European Union without a deal come 31st of October, it is possible that tariffs could be put on steel exported from the UK. And clearly, if you are a European company looking to place an order of steel with British Steel, you might be nervous about that prospect. So you might go elsewhere. The company said orders dried up.
But obviously, it's Grable who own the Scunthorpe plant. But what could have, I mean, there are thousands of jobs on the line here. What could have been done to stop this from happening?
It may be further down the line in a few weeks that Greg Clark and the government have a tough decision to make. Do they nationalise it or do they let it go bust? Clearly, letting it go bust would have severe consequences.
Is nationalising it actually on the table?
It has not been ruled out. I suspect the government would much rather do some sort of public-private partnership. That would be an easier political sell for a Conservative government. And also letting British Steel go bust would have other consequences for the government. It's a blast furnace plant. There are only two left in the UK. Going down from two to one would have severe implications if you believe that steel is a strategic industry, that it's important for not just the railways, but for defence.
You were saying to me when we talked about this the other day that some people are kind of tend to agree with Trump, actually, on the importance of a steel industry to a country.
Well, Trump's famous quote on the subject is steel is, if you don't have a steel industry, you don't have a proper country. Now, not everybody agrees with everything Trump says, but that sentiment would be shared by quite a lot of people across quite a wide range of the political spectrum. It is an important industry. It's known as a foundation industry, and it supplies other core industries such as aerospace, such as automotive.
So if steel is so important, why isn't it then getting the same sector deals as those industries you just mentioned, like the car industry?
Well, the suspicion would be that the government is wedded to an ideology that says steel doesn't matter that much, and that actually let the market provide, and that it shouldn't subsidise businesses that are loss-making.
So at the moment, it seems that the business secretary, Greg Clark, has bought some time whilst they try and find a buyer.
The world needs steel, and there's no better steel than British Steel. So I hope that we, together, and that's the point of coming to meet the workforce and the unions and the management, that we can make a good case for a new investor to take this business forward.
But we still don't know how much the government is willing to spend on buying time to look for a buyer, and if that's even going to happen. So Nils, what happens if the Scunthorpe plant closes?
Well, if it closes, then 5,000 people would lose their jobs, and that would have a devastating impact on that part of the world, on North Lincolnshire in particular, because, you know, what are the replacement jobs that would come in? If Scunthorpe were to go down, that is a blow, severe blow, to the UK's steelmaking capacity.
And have you struggled?
It was lovely. It was hard. I had a lot of mollycoddling from my wife and some of my friends, and I'm more of a let's get on with it kind of person. But I understood where they were coming from, because they seen the changes in me. I didn't see them changes, but they did.
So a lot has changed in the region around Redcar. But one of the things is that Brian used to be a Labour councillor and a huge part of the trade union. But things have changed for him on that front as well, haven't they?
So Brian was Labour councillor until 3 weeks ago in the local elections, when he decided not to stand. And it was funny, actually, while I was interviewing him on the beach, his phone rang.
Hello?
And he was quite, gave whoever it was quite short shrift, and just went, yeah.
Yes, I've already voted. in the Brexit party.
Brexit party, yeah. I'll ring you later.
I'm down in Redcar. I'll ring you back about half an hour. Okay, bye.
I said to him, what's all that about? And he said,
my sister, we've been arguing for...
So she wanted to know who I'd voted for. You know, we've been arguing about this since 2016.
You voted Brexit party, even though you were Labour councillor until 3 weeks ago.
And he said...
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Why has he changed then to vote for the Brexit party?
Well, he voted Leave in the referendum, and he feels that the Labour MEPs in the area, with whom he had, you know, frequent contact, given that he was a Labour politician, he just felt they didn't stand up for Redcar Steel enough.
And I was saying to them, well, why aren't you screaming from the rooftops? Why aren't you in the press every day saying there's 5,000 jobs on Teesside going to the war because the government won't help, and don't let them kid you? I said, where's the condemnation from you? So I absolutely voted Brexit. I think we will forge our own way.
Right, and he isn't the only one changing his party and his political leaning. Tell us about how things have shifted in the area.
The northeast of England, particularly the sort of post-industrial north, has long been thought of as Labour Party heartland. And then if you look at the results of the European Parliament election from this week, in Redcar and Cleveland, the Brexit Party absolutely romped it. They got over 14,800 votes.
There is a lot of blame on the EU for what's gone on. And Nigel Farage came out, he directly blamed the EU for the difficulties at British Steel. Is that something that a lot of people agree with?
I'd say for most people, the kind of the machinations of how the EU works is not at the forefront of their mind. But I tell you what nobody did. Nobody said, oh, all this uncertainty about Brexit must be making it really difficult for steel companies to plan ahead. Nobody actually said that, but that is something which Gareth Stace, who is the Director General of the Trade Association UK Steel, that is a point that he made in a very powerful article he wrote for The Observer on the weekend, when he said, you know, I must be honest in stating that Brexit will not improve the situation for the steel sector, but it has the potential to cause a great deal of damage. And he was responding to claims by Nigel Farage and others that laid the blame for steel's demise, you know, squarely at the EU's door.
How did it feel then, having been back in Redcar after 2015, 4 years down the line?
You know, when I was there last week, it was just beautiful weather. The sun was shining. I was eating a lemon top, which is like this Teesside speciality ice cream.
Where they're delicious.
Yeah. It's like a kind of Mr. Whippy that's got a lemon swirl on the top. And I was eating an ice cream and looking out at the sea, and the cliffs were behind me. And then you kind of look to one direction, and then you just see the steelworks still there. These enormous, you know, the blast furnace, the coke ovens, the conveyor belts. And you think, goodness, I thought it's kind of a really sort of poignant reminder of everything that Redcar has lost.
I know what I went through, and I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. It takes people to dark places when they see the livelihood go. The skills that these lads have down there are unique to an industry.
I really, really deeply hope that Redcar can reinvent itself. You know, a bit like Sheffield has, actually. You know, Sheffield used to be the steel city. And now, you know, its university just last week was awarded the award for best engineering research in the UK. So it is possible. But I think that there's still quite a bit of pain and misery ahead. And there are a lot of external forces that will buffet the town, which has already struggled so much as a result of austerity, that I can't say with any certainty that it will not only be able to recover, but also thrive. But I really hope that it can.
You can follow Helen Pidd and Nils Prattley's work on this story at theguardian.com. Coming up, the unsolved 1996 murder of a French filmmaker in West Cork in Ireland. Now, it's a murder case that's bewitched Ireland. Soon after Sophie Toscan de Plantier's body was found in 1996, Irish police identified Ian Bailey, who lived nearby, as the prime suspect. He was never charged, and he's always proclaimed his innocence. But this week, he's on trial in his absence in a French court. Our Ireland correspondent Rory Carroll spoke to him.
It was just before Christmas in 1996 that the body of Sophie Toscan de Plantier was discovered in a rural picturesque area of West Cork. Her body was badly bludgeoned and she had been murdered. She was a French filmmaker, and the murder attracted a lot of attention in Ireland. It was so unusual and so tragic. She had been staying alone at a holiday cottage in West Cork, and there were no witnesses to this murder. Soon afterwards, a local English freelance journalist, Ian Bailey, who was a near neighbour of Sophie, started filing stories about the murder investigation, and he appeared to be getting some good scoops on this. And then there was a shocking twist to this, which was that Ian Bailey became the prime suspect in the murder investigation. The Irish police, known as the Gardaí, brought him in for questioning, and this was the beginning of a 23-year saga, which to this day remains unresolved. The Gardaí were, and I think remain, convinced that Ian Bailey did it, but they've never been able to get enough evidence to actually convince prosecutors to charge him. There was no forensic evidence linking Ian Bailey to the murder. So Ian Bailey has been living this very strange and tortuous limbo for 23 years. He's always pled his innocence from day one up until this day. So now the story has become a soap opera in Ireland, and now we're seeing the latest chapter with the start of the French trial against Ian Bailey. Investigation has taken so many twists and turns. What's remarkable is that he's never left West Cork. He remains there, living in a kind of bohemian lifestyle to make ends meet. He makes pizzas and then he sells them at a local market on the Sunday. The local joke is that his pizzas are to die for. And this is indicative of the strange kind of atmosphere and vibe surrounding the whole case. I mean, it all hinges on, did he do it or not? Ian Bailey, he's been the subject of a podcast called West Cork, which has become a huge viral hit. And anybody who's listened to it, I think, would conclude that he has a narcissistic streak and that he actually enjoys this attention. And when I met him and spent a day with him in West Cork, this was my impression as well.
I don't know. All I know is there are people here in Ireland who know I have nothing to do with it. And they're hiding behind a code of omerta, silence and denial.
We went out for a lunch in a cafe in Bantry, and Bailey wanted to show that he is now no longer a pariah in the community, and in fact that he has friends and supporters. We were sitting outside and he would kind of wave at people and to show that, in fact, he is welcome there. And the reaction from some people was mixed. And there was also slightly kind of dark comic scene where he was asking the waitress, "Oh, are you from Latvia?" And she looked at him and arched an eyebrow and said, "No, I'm from France." One of the reasons the police identified him early on as a suspect was that he had a record of domestic violence against his partner. He had at least 3 times assaulted her. So yes, he has a history of violence, but does this prove that he murdered Sophie Toscan de Plantier? No, it doesn't. So the French authorities have started a trial this week in Paris, charging Ian Bailey with murder. He is not attending, nor are his lawyers, so he's being tried in absentia. And his expectation is that he will be convicted. If he is convicted, which I think does seem quite likely, the expectation is that the French will then try to extradite him to serve what could be a potential life sentence. But a lot of lawyers here in Ireland feel that it's not going to happen, that the Irish will not grant that appeal, in which case we'll be left with continued limbo, whereby Bailey is free in Ireland, but he cannot really leave Ireland because these French arrest warrants are European-wide. What this means is that Bailey is a de facto prisoner on the island of Ireland, and he can't leave here. Either here you have an innocent man who has been persecuted and smeared for more than 2 decades, or you have a savage murderer who's living in the community and got away with his murder, and that everybody kind of knows, they think, inverted commas, they know that he did it, and yet he's there selling his pizzas. It's one of those two situations, and frankly, we probably will never know which one it is.
You can read more of Rory's reporting on the case at theguardian.com. That's all for today. My thanks to Rory Carroll and to Helen Pidd, Nils Prattley, Brian and Linda. Today's episode was produced by Brenna Daldorf and Gary Marshall. The sound design is by Axel Kakutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll see you tomorrow.